Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about how to run a D&D one-shot. Like, what's the best way to condense a D&D game to just a few hours, and what scenarios work best for a one-shot like that? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we start the discussion, I will remind our viewers that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our private video chat. That is a private chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, which you can join in on. It's available to all of our patrons. So just join our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Pop on there, join at any tier. You'll get an invite to our private Discord server, and we will start the after-party chat in about an hour, maybe a little extra. We take a little break in between the show and the chat, but then right around 2:10 Eastern time, we will be in there to chat.
We would love to see you there. So, Paul, what you came up with this interesting idea to discuss one shots? What brought that to mind?
Oh, it's a funny story. I have an image to share about it. So I was just scrolling, doom scrolling, if you will, through Facebook, and I noticed a friend of mine posted this post that said, the universe is telling me I need to get good at DMing D&D one-shots. Any suggestions for how to do that? And so my instinct, a couple of responses went through my head, and I thought, oh, I can respond with this or respond with that. I'm like, okay, now I'm going to flood my poor friend with a wall of text. And I thought, oh, I bet we've talked about it on the show. I'll just drop him a link to the show where we talked about it. And we kind of haven't. I mean, we talked a little bit. There's a show, I think, from maybe season one or two where we talk about convention games versus campaign style play, right? And so that certainly touches on the topic, and I'm sure we've touched on the topic in a dozen other shows, but we've never just sat down and said, here is our advice for running a one-shot. So I thought it would be fun to actually do that, Dan, and then, you know, we'll have this video to regale our friends with down the road when they say, how do I run a one-shot? And I just go, here you go, here's the link.
I think it's a great idea, honestly, and it's a great way for people that are, you know, maybe getting into the hobby either as players or DMs for the first time. It's a great way to step in, try it out one time. You and I, Paul, run lots of one shots. I mean, arguably, we do that more than we do like really long form campaign play. It's something that we do a lot.
My standard answer these days when people ask me, what are you currently running? And I'm like, gosh, you know, I don't really have a campaign currently, and I haven't for a few years now. I would love to have one, but I don't. But I do go to a lot of conventions and I other events, people's birthdays, whatever. Something comes up and I go, sure, I'll run a one-shot game and I do that. So maybe you're attending a convention, or maybe you just have some friends who would love to just play a one-off game for a few hours in an evening. We're going to cover all that, really, like how to get the most out of just a one-off game, one shot.
Definitely.
Let's talk a little bit like expectations here. So, like, I would say at most conventions that I go to, RPGs are scheduled for about a four-hour block. I'd say that's fairly reasonable. Maybe it's a little shorter if you're just having friends over for an evening in the midweek. Maybe you're squeezing it down to three. I'd say, honestly, 3 hours is not a terrible thing to target in general, because, you know, there's some buffer time at the con, right? Maybe people take a little while to settle down and pick their characters, and maybe you want a little time at the end to debrief, and talk a little bit about how the game went. So I feel like targeting three to four hours is probably a good expectation of how long a one shot should take.
Yeah. You know, as a meta topic, right, I'm not surprised, Paul, that basically the first thing you're talking about is what's the time, because I feel like, to me, the number one super topic is time management in these kinds of situations. And it's something that, it's weird, because for me, I'm hyper aware of it now, I guess. And yet I'm always perpetually really challenged by the time management issues. So I guess among the things I would say is, like, number one, like, show up on time. you're gonna be there on time. And if there's, you know, if there's issues, like, I don't know, like maybe like daylight saving time starting that day, you're gonna be aware about that, and you're gonna be there on the correct time. It is really important. So don't mess up the time switches if that's happening now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. For those of our international viewers may not realize, today is daylight savings here last night was here in the U.S. And yeah, hopefully we haven't surprised all our viewers by being on an hour earlier than we normally are.
And most of the U.S., if you have friends in some states, they may not honor that. So it's really just a wonderful. It's true. It's a wonderful tradition that we have here, and I'm just so glad that we all lost an hour of sleep last night for some dumb reason that somebody came up with. And the leaded gasoline, that was a great idea. So many great societal ideas, really. I'm just like I'm on a roll today.
Let me get back to your time management issue, Dan. I have one like really solid piece of advice that I would say to anyone running a one shot. Which has a lot to do with time, which is very simply this: don't include character creation. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
You'll be tempted to.
Yeah.
You'll try to make it work. I've seen dozens of people try to make it work.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't work. It doesn't fit. It takes too much time. So either show up with pre-generated characters, or if this is like a casual thing with friends, make characters offline, do it however you can, right? Like empower them to make the characters before they show up, or have a separate meeting first with them to make the characters, whatever. Just don't include it in your one-shot window. There's not enough time. I promise you there's not enough time.
I have made this mistake, right? I also second Paul's recommendation there, because I have absolutely fought against this. When I started running some convention games, I was like, I want to give the full classic D&D experience. And part of that experience is making your own characters. And I mean, they're pretty brief, I would say to myself. They're pretty minimalist. There's nothing in the original rule books about using pre-generated characters. It's like roll the abilities and pick the class and all this kind of stuff. So when I started with con games, even for original D&D, I absolutely committed to that part of the experience. And just like Paul said, there just isn't time. I do not care how or what you think is going to happen, but it just doesn't work in that case. So yes, I'm totally committed to the pre-generated characters now. And of course, you know, they are in most of the classic adventures, so it's not like it's a total taboo either.
And this will also give you more control over some of the things. Like I noticed there was a comment. Here, I want to put this up on our screen, if I can remember how to do that. Here you go. William said, the biggest thing that trips me up running a one-shot is magic items that allow going Nova, all the wand charges, right? Like, yeah, so pre-generated characters are going to give you a little more control, right, over that, because you'll decide what magic items your characters are coming in with. Wand charges is an interesting one. I want to touch on that one specifically. Dan, you have a take on this, right? How many wand charges should a wand have for a one-shot game?
I'm so glad you asked. I would recommend like three. Three seems to be about the magic number, right? And I feel like in a lot of narrative fiction or movies or something like that, if someone has like what you'd call a gag, right? Someone has like a superpowered gag, you're probably going to see it maybe three times. And in fact, you know, it's funny because I was just running a couple of short games in the last couple of weeks, and I was thinking to myself, either two or three, like maybe even two is okay. You try it once, you try it twice, and the third time, surprise, it doesn't work. And now you have to do something different on that third beat. So actually, like as limited as two or three, I think is okay.
Wow. That's less than I was expecting you to say, but it makes sense, right? Because it probably more emulates what campaign play is like, because probably when your players in a campaign have a wand, they're not going to blow all the charges in a single day of adventuring, right? They're going to be a little more conservative. So, yeah, it probably better emulates the, you know, traditional D&D experience to just have a handful of charges. I thought I remembered, and maybe it varies based on what level you're at, because I thought I remember playing games with you, Dan, where you had us roll 2d10. You're like, you have 2d10 charges, which is still, I think, a pretty good number, right? If you're playing a high level, we're 8th, 9th level characters, and my wizard has a wand of fireballs, 2d10 charges, you could still end up with 2 or 3, and you're going to at most come away with 20, which is quite a lot, honestly. So, yeah, maybe even 1d10 or 1d6. I don't know.
It's something I've evolved on, Paul, even just in the last week. Even just last week, I was running some improvised games, and I was like, you know what, two or three feels okay to me. So yeah, I've probably dropped that recently. Nice. That's a great point. And I will say that it's something that classic D&D maybe helps you out a little bit more, because you can come into the game with a specific, discrete, finite number of charges in your wands. Like, I believe, if I recall correctly, 5th edition specifically has like a certain number per day, you'd step in. This is what the wand's supposed to do every single day separately. And you and I saw that as a little bit of an issue with the big bad, is sure enough, someone came in and just burned all the charges out immediately on one of the wands and didn't care about the small possibility that the wand breaks as a result. So that is something we didn't quite have the fine-tuned control over in those rules.
I mean, I've seen there's a nice mechanic in 5th edition that you could use. And I don't remember if there's magic items that follow this, but I see it a lot for monsters, and especially like the one big one that I always remember is Dragon Breath, where it's simply after the dragon breathes, you roll a d6, and like you have to roll a d6 to see if it's ready again, right? So I could imagine doing have a wand and just say, like, every time you use it, roll a d6, and on a 1 or 2, you're out of charges. That would be an interesting way to get a little variance in there of, like, I don't know exactly how many charges are going to be in there, but not a lot.
It's not a bad mechanic. I actually don't mind that mechanic at all. And if that had been the original dragon rule, I wouldn't have minded, actually. It's really not terrible. There might be some maybe 5th edition players that might not like that kind of ad hoc adjustment, possibly. But I think it's a good idea myself.
Yeah, right. All right. What else, Dan? When we're talking about time management, what else immediately jumps to mind?
Before we do that, let's talk a little bit more about the pre-gen character issue. Because I think that one thing, and I think we've mentioned it a couple times in the past, is you and I coincidentally came up with a very similar mechanism for presenting the pre-gens to the players when they sit at the table. Maybe talk a little bit about what you do there.
Are you, I guess you're referring to specifically to the horror games I run, because I don't think I've ever done this for D&D, though it would work for sure, which is not actually giving them the character sheets to choose from, but rather some condensed format. In my horror games, I just give a tent, right? A little like foldable, piece of cardstock that just has like their name and maybe like a fact about the character. And in the horror games, I often a physical prop as well. So there's a few pieces of information from which to choose the character from, but not the entire character sheet, because that's overwhelming, right? That's a lot for a player to take in.
Again, this is a time management issue, right? We've both in the past printed out a bunch of standard character sheets, dumped the pile on the table, and said, you guys pick them. And that would cause, every single player at the table, which might be as many as 8, to shuffle through 8 to 10 pieces of paper and have to parse it, and then possibly have a discussion. That possibly takes a long time. So this is another mechanism that we're using to cut down that get into the play, is give them a smaller limited slice of information to pick from. Maybe pull up the image of what I do.
I was noticing you have a little visual aid here. What are we looking at?
So for what it's worth, what I do and what you were looking at there are the pre-generated characters for the classic Ace series of modules for AD&D, the Against the Slavers series, which uses the same characters that are kind of fairly well known. So, again, I do run a little bit of a crunchy game. So what I have here is a bunch of mailing labels that I print this stuff out on, 1x4-inch mailing labels, with the basic ideas of, race, class, what's interesting about them, what kind of interesting equip, maybe magical items they have, maybe the top level spells, the kind of spells that the spellcasters have available. And then I actually roll, I do have the players roll for precedence about how they're going to pick, and then they just take this sheet of labels, pass it around the table, read this, and each person in sequence gets to make their choice, takes the label off the sheet, puts it on an index card that they're going to fold up, very similar to what Paul was saying, and have a little place card there for me, the DM, and everybody else to see who they're playing. And so that greatly, and then I go give them the character sheet, and they can parse the one thing that they've chosen based on this. Now, and that works just super neat, and it's, you know, the pre-made labels just work really super well. Now, I will say that maybe if you're running a game that's more, you know, deep into the role playing, then maybe you don't have things like equipment or abilities. Maybe you have little personality or background bits on that, things that you're picking from. And that would be another way to do it. But very brief, like about one or two sentences is probably enough to give people a hook in what choice they're making about these characters.
Yeah, well, I think one of the more successful ones I've done in a horror role-playing game where it is much more about the personality and less about the stats is I had the character's name and then a quote spoken in their voice, something that character was likely to say, right? And that helps really kind of give the personality a little bit, a nod of what the character's like.
I like the die roll mechanism too. Having one little quote to get into the character, that was part of our discussion last week about character acting, and people should watch that if you want to know more about how to get into that quickly.
Yeah. I like your note about using a die roll too to determine the order of picks, because that can become a point that slows things down as people have discussions about which one are you taking, and maybe I'll take this one, and then you know, some, maybe two players are hemming and hawing and another person just jumps in and just grabs. And then it's, you know, I think the whole process is just much smoother if you just leave it to random chance and you just, you know, die roll or just go around the table or whatever order you want to do and just be like, you get first pick, you get second, done.
I agree. And again, to begin with, I was like, I want to commit to full on democracy. I want to have everybody have a say and do this, but then, you know, and then there'll be someone that's a little bit more proactive than others that makes that happen. So I once again, I resisted that. And I do think the rolling for priority makes things go a lot slicker with one. And I will say, if someone has played in that series, I mean, this might be weird, but if someone's played in that series and has used a particular character, I do give them a right of first refusal to keep using that same character is what I do. If there happens to be a chain series, and that kind of works pretty well.
Another piece of advice around characters before we get onto, I want to get here, Dan, to content, like what kind of adventures to run, because I think that's a big one. But one last point about characters. If you're running a deadly game like original Dungeons & Dragons, a game where like you want character death to be on the table, I would recommend having more pre-gens than players. Have a larger group. Usually what I end up doing is I won't spend a lot of time explaining, but if a player's character dies very early in the game, I will let them pull in a new character. So-and-so arrives last minute. Sorry, I'm late. And there's your new character, and that gets them back in the game. And I might do something where I will disallow this within, say, the last hour of play, right? Just to say, like, nope, right? There's a chance of TPK here, right? There's a chance that everything goes pear-shaped. But I find, like, if you're running a one-shot and you've got six players and somebody dies in the first hour, it's a real bummer for that player, right? They're basically excluded from the game throughout the rest of the session. It's less of a bummer if you're only missing out on like the last, you know, hour, half hour of play, whatever, the small bit. And you're like, well, that happens, right? Character died, sorry. So maybe have some extra characters so that player who dies can come back in as a different character. And maybe consider having a cutoff of like when you're not going to allow that anymore. And do something arbitrary like wall clock time so that
you know,
it doesn't feel like a player is getting specifically punished for dying.
Agreed. I agree. You know, it's funny, just as an aside, I was, having an interview with somebody about D&D a couple weeks ago, and I had an opportunity to ask one specific question. The one specific question was, do you have TPKs in your games? And the answer was, yes, we have TPKs. And I was like, good for you. I'm glad to hear that. So yes, that's something you should be aware and prepare for.
Awesome. All right, let's talk about content, Dan. What kind of if I want to run a one shot, how do I find an adventure or write an adventure, whatever I'm going to do, that's going to fit in this constrained time? How do I know that it's going to fit?
Well, of course, you have an option of grabbing something that someone else wrote, and you have the option of writing your own. So maybe let's think about grabbing a pre-made one to begin with. And I've spent, many years digging into the classic D&D adventures, some written by, Mr. Gygax, and see how they play. A lot of them were first run in convention situations, predominantly in a couple hours. So I kind of have been interested in digging in, see how well they play. So you can run any of the classic early D&D adventures, like the Against the Giant series was originally convention, the Descent Against the Drow series, the Slavers modules are among the best to make it really clear how to run it in a limited time slot. So I like grabbing stuff like that and kind of being aware about it. Again, the interesting thing about the A series with the Against the Slavers is that they're very precise about here's the campaign version, a very elaborate dungeon, and here's the much more minimalist tournament 4-hour slot dungeon, which is just a subset of the big thing. And it's, to my knowledge, even though convention games were so important in the early days, it's the only example of a module that makes that distinction. Says if you're running this limited time slot, just use this limited dungeon, which has, and the guidelines at the time were about 7 encounters. About 7 encounters is what we're going to get through. It's probably going to be a pretty linear dungeon, actually, to make sure everybody gets to these beats that are interesting. So I do think that that's at least an option of grabbing the earliest possible adventures and using that, because that's how they were initially used.
So I'm gonna totally disagree with you, Dan. I do not like those adventures as one shots.
Okay, all right.
And here's why. And the reason, I think, was what you're getting at the end of how linear they actually are. Now, I agree with you, the amount of content, probably 7 plus or minus a little bit, is probably the number of encounters you're going to get through in the course of your adventure. Now, the thing that I like, though, is I generally like to have content that has maybe a little more content than the players are likely to be able to get through, but multiple paths, right? I definitely do. I'm not a fan of the linear nature of some of those early modules, especially the A series. They're very like, yep, you just get this order. And the problem with that, I think, is that there may be some very satisfying end encounter, and it's very possible that you won't reach it in time, right? That the amount of content is just too great, or whatever, the players go slow, and then you end up in this unfortunate position of either A, going long, or B, just cutting them off and saying, sorry, we ran out of time, you didn't make it to the end. And I find both of those pretty unsatisfying. One of my favorite sources for pre-made content for one-shots is the one-page dungeon contests. I don't know if they still run those, but like around the early 2000s, I think is when I was most aware of them, or maybe around maybe the late 2000s, 2009, 2010, something like that. I think I can't remember.
I think I was one of the judges in like 2016, I think. So
okay. I'm betting that they still run them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's one as an example that I actually really like. It's called Citadel of the Severed Hand by Rob S. If you just Google Citadel of the Severed Hand, you're going to find this. It's 12 locations, which is a great, you know, is a bit more than what we were just saying, a bit more than 7, right? But there's multiple entrances to the dungeon, right? So it begins with the players outside of the dungeon trying to make their way in. There's multiple ways they can enter. There's multiple paths through to get to the end. There's no reason for the players to have to necessarily reach the final spot. And it's really nice. It's a nice adventure. It's short, right? Like one page is very easy to, you know, just have in front of you and go. There's plenty of room for you as DM to expand or interpret, but it's, I don't know, it's a good size, about perfect size module for me for a one shot.
That's dope. There is one, and I don't disagree with what Paul's saying about these concerns. As a matter of fact, I would say much the same thing. There's a one shot I believe called The Scepter of Yalacha. That I have in my binder as a really great one shot for particularly new players in a limited session, and I can't say as I've actually had the opportunity to run it, but I've prepped it specifically for that kind of purpose. Might be more linear than this one, but I agree that grabbing one of those one page dungeons is actually a great choice for this kind of thing.
I have a second one here that I'll recommend that I've also run many times as a one shot, which I'll also, I agree with, is a little more linear, which is the Vault of Zerduzan. It's also a good one. It's maybe a little higher level than the previous one. If you're running this in classic D&D, and yes, there's a single entrance. There is definitely, it's a little more linear, but there are plenty of rooms you can pass by and not do, There's certainly stuff. Now, this, as written, this is 22 rooms, and that's a lot. That is, it is. You're probably not going to get through this whole thing in the course of a one shot. So what do you do about that? And I have thoughts. I have some techniques, but I was curious if you have thoughts on how to, yeah.
And this is stuff that I've had to learn through being battle tested over and over again, because I will say the A series seems to work pretty well for me. I think that those R's do seem to be set up pretty well, that when I run those, I do consistently get through all the content to the big climax that they've got at the end. Seems to work pretty well, even though I traditionally have pretty bad time management.
I hear you. I just want to pick on one thing you said there, which is yeah. really great, which is that it's that you learn the stuff through battle testing, right? And that's absolutely a piece of advice I would give anyone running one shots is run the same one shot multiple times if you can.
Yes.
Right. The same one shot multiple times. Different players are gonna have different experiences. Your first one might just be an outlier. Practice makes perfect, right? Like yes, if you can run the same one multiple times, that is a like if the goal here is how do I get better at doing this, the answer is practice the same thing over and over again a couple times.
Those I cannot agree with that. That actually hits very close to my heart at the moment, and we're going to be talking more about that issue at some point in the near future. Anyway, totally agree with that. I love digging in and kind of exploring a particular scenario to a deep level like that, learning more about it, refining it more is something I actually really, really enjoy doing. So if you do get an opportunity, like, you know, don't be embarrassed about that. Go for it. Now the places where I've been bad, right? The places where I have been super bad is when I grab something like the Against the Giants modules, which are big, you know, pretty big, elaborate dungeons. Hear that they were used for convention play and weren't really tuned, I think in retrospect, weren't really tuned for that kind of event. Is people just were thrown, and you know, Gary would just grab his gargantuan Greyhawk dungeon, sit down at a convention, is like, great, you're exploring Greyhawk. Just you can go anywhere, you can do anything, I don't know what's gonna happen. And just like our viewers here, like Ash are pointing out, and other folks and Josh. You know, getting to an interesting, satisfying climax is pretty darn unlikely in that kind of situation. So I've had these kind of meandering, kind of not going anywhere in a huge mega dungeon type situations, and that's not great. So to answer Paul's question about what do, you've got to pre-plan. You've got to pre-plan what the interesting beats are first, if you are going to cut down something larger than that. And it might seem kind of obvious, but for example, it was a tip that we got from our friend Satine Phoenix when she appeared on a prior episode, a prior season, is jot down the expected time, right? Jot down some tentpole times. If I expect them to be here in the first half hour, here at the end of at the first 1 hour, right here after 90 minutes, and more or less plan out the beats that you expect to get to in this kind of thing. And that'll allow you to adjust if things are going slower or faster than you initially expected. And so if you do see that things are going slower than expected, you can start to edit, you can start to abbreviate, or you can think about cutting out a particular encounter that isn't quite so important before you run into the time crunch at the end.
And it's an interesting point, right? So one of the reasons I like one that's slightly too much, right? Whether it's a dozen or in this case, 22 rooms, is that I think it's easier to cut than to fill, right? It's easier to remove stuff. So, you know, yeah, if you know, like the major beats, I want them to get through these points of the dungeon, you know, and you notice like, oh, we're already behind, start cutting stuff. It's very easy to cut stuff, right? Just remove content entirely or alter it in such a way that it makes it trivial for them to get through, right? Maybe this room had an animated statue that attacks the players when they try to get through, but they're behind. So in this case, it doesn't work. It's just a statue, right? And then you can push on, right? So I think that's very helpful. The other thing is consider the ability for your major encounters to move. So for example, if the if the dungeon ends in a big climactic battle with the main boss and the players are being very slow about things, maybe you can decide, well, the boss is aware of them and he brings the fight to them. Oh, he just shows up.
Right.
You can, you know, do stuff like that. So like, you know, so you can get those beats in and have that satisfying arc, right? Before the clock time runs out.
That's good. Alternatively, and I think I've done this, like particularly if, you know, commonly the last room has some kind of interesting geography to it, right? So it might have chasm or some swinging implements or a magical cauldron that's important. And so I've edited the dungeon on the fly. I've like these three or four or five rooms, just they're not there anymore. Or I just hand wave the whole, you go through a series of four or five rooms and there isn't anything there and you keep moving on.
You can also do that. That may be a case where something like the Ace series or something that's more linear is actually easier because you can just pull out rooms, right? It's a little harder when you have a more maze-like thing and they're mapping or something and the thing's got to make sense. But maybe I'll use this as an opportunity then to slide over to an adventure I wrote that I love to use as one shots, where I tried to use some of the stuff. And thought a lot about that. I'm like, this is going to be a one shot. So I thought a lot about how to make content for that. One of the things that I love about the tournament modules that I think is really good to bring to your one shots is to make sure there's a goal, right? Whatever it is, whether it's defeat the bad guy, find your way out, you know, whatever the goal is, make sure that there's a clear goal for the players to achieve. I think the tournaments are generally always very good at that. And it's nice. It keeps the players motivated. Keeps them pushing through the content to try and reach the end. Here's a one page that I wrote called Gloomwood Falls. This was actually kind of extracted from a campaign. This is another great way if you're looking for content to run for a one shot. If you've run a campaign in the past and you're like, hey, that one session was great, see if you can extract it. See if you can just pull that out and rerun that little bit of your campaign for other people.
Yes.
So this map, if you look, you can see. I'm going to zoom in on the map here. This is the, I think 25 or 20, actually maybe 28 locations on this map. Now the goal of this map, the goal of this adventure was it's you're in underground caverns and you're underneath a large you're in a cliffside and you're looking for a way to the top. You're just trying to find a way through. You're hoping that this is going to be a shortcut rather than climbing these horrible, you know, deadly cliffs. So the nice thing about this dungeon is there are no less than three locations in the dungeon where you can find a way up. Right. Okay. So there's multiple paths to success here. As I look at this, if I remember correctly, I think that there's one at location 12, which is in the bottom right. There's one at location 10, which is in the top left. And I think there's a third one. I think it's location 24 in the top right. So there's kind of multiple ways for the players to find success, right? So they may even, like, if they start to go down a path and it's too difficult, they can backtrack and go a different way and whatnot. So there's that. There's also a terrible villain up there in room 25. There is like a major dramatic end fight that could happen. It's a lich, and I have in the past run this where the players decided to hole up. They were like, "Oh no, we're really injured. Let's lock ourselves in this room and let's you know hole up and then we can go and tackle more of the content." And I'm looking at the clock, going like, "Well, dang, we got like half an hour left, guys. There's not really time for this." And so I decided, "Great, the lich comes for them."
Okay.
Heard them Great. Bumbling around. He's coming. Bangs Great. On the door. Here
Great.
I am.
Great. Yep.
So you kind of bolt all those techniques in one here in this particular adventure.
I feel like there's a joke here, like knock knock, who's there? Lich. Lich who? That's really all you're already dead. No, that's the end of the joke was on the third line.
You know, it was actually that instance of running this game at a convention is one of my absolute favorites because when the Lich did show up, they were of course in the state where they felt like, oh no, we're really hurt, we're trying to recover. This is really, really bad, right? He's coming at us when we're down on resources. And so one of the players actually just tried to engage the Lich in conversation and work out a nonviolent, basically offered himself up, right? Basically just said, look, if you let my friends pass, you know, I will stay with you forever and be your loyal servant. And the Lich took him up on it. I was like, great. The end. That's how the adventure ended for us. They made it through, but one of their party was left behind with the Lich. And it's nice because it kind of leaves the door open for, I don't know, maybe there's a sequel down the road of like, we got to go save our friend from that Lich.
That's excellent. That's great. Super nice. So the point about you know, not liking it entirely linear is fair. You know, if you're limited on design time, right, it's an obvious choice, right? I feel like there's no sin if you are, you know, time constrained on the design end and you have to do this to crank something out. That's okay. Agreed that it would be better if you had some other options, but at the same time, you can't have just an open-ended mega dungeon with, well, I mean, you can, but it's not, admittedly, if you're looking for a compelling, memorable climax at the end of your one shot, that's an open-ended mega dungeon is not going to guarantee that that happens. It probably won't. We all agree with that. So yep. having a design where you do have like a particular climactic, interesting endpoint is a reasonable design. And yeah, possibly having multiple paths to pick from, so that there's an interesting exploration decision to get there, that's perfectly fine too. And so, Paul, you know, you had, you know, multiple possible exit points, which is interesting. The terminal module in the A series does that, right? So Dungeons of the Slave Lords does that same thing. If you're trapped and there's either three or four exits. As in our experience, one is more likely than the others. Okay, I mean, how can that not be the case, really? And yep. Then Ash, in a prior comment here, I'll just throw that up on screen, was saying, yeah, I think Ghost Tower of Inverness is like that. Absolutely, you're right about that, Ash. There's a central climax point, and there's, I think, four different ways to get in there that you get to pick from. Mensers, I think it was by Frank Mensers' famous Falks the Dragon tournament series, does the same thing. There's several potions, I think, several silver dragon control potions that were stolen. You go into a dungeon, there's like four different terminal locations you can fight through to get one of them. So yeah, that's a strong design choice. Be aware that when you do that, at least the first time, three quarters of that isn't going to get used by your players. But particularly if you plan to reuse it over and over again, and that's like what Mensur's thing was meant to do, then you are going to get to for some future playthrough session.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my favorite things about running Gloomwood Falls, which I've run many times now, again, because there's 28 locations and there's multiple endpoints for success. It's actually very entertaining to me as DM to watch different groups go through it and which way out did they find and what, you know, clever things did they do and how did they get past this, you know, this issue or that issue. I mean, that one group talking to the Lich is like one of my favorite anecdotes now because it was totally unexpected and delightful.
That's excellent. That's great.
But I mean, there is an argument. There's a good argument, I think, for a more linear design. Again, as you're saying it, like, it is easier. It's definitely easier to make cuts, I think, in a linear design. Right? It's easier. I'm sure if I was looking at the maps for the A series, I could say, like, yeah, I'm running out of time. I'm just going to skip this whole room. It doesn't work so well if you're, like, actually trying to use the tournament grading system to grade them, but that's a whole separate goal. I guess that's, you know, maybe that's worth talking about. It's like, what is your goal in running this one shot, right? Is this just a fun night with friends? Is this a convention game, right? Are you trying to craft a specific experience? Are you trying to, using it as a way to introduce the game to people who don't play often? So you're trying to, like, you know, hook them? You know, that's probably in the last case there, it's more important to have that nice, fun, exciting climax. Where if it's a more casual thing with just some friends and you're just like, we haven't played in a while, we're going to get together for a one shot. You maybe have a little more flexibility on time. Maybe you're like, yeah, they might stay an extra hour, in which case, great, go for it.
Agreed. Yeah, I think in a lot of those cases, yeah. So I do some of both, right? So I if I am, that's a great point. If I am running for brand new players, which I love to do, and sometimes people say, Dan, I'm going to introduce you to so and so to play D&D. Then I do try to think about having that interesting climax moment. And then if I have more experienced players or ones, people that I know better, then, you know, a one shot is also a great opportunity in that kind of context to have some kind of like novel, challenging design. So, like I've done with you and some of our friends, Paul, sometimes I run out totally novel mechanics that I haven't, you know, I wouldn't want to commit to in a long running campaign yet. I think in one of our recent games, maybe last year, I ran a game where all the characters all got shrunk down to a minuscule size. So it was like a very different environment they were dealing with. And then in addition, I also threw in a mechanic where I just flipped around the way the D20 worked entirely. So instead of trying to roll high, you're trying to roll low instead, just to see how that worked. And you know, there's mathematical benefits to that, and some players were weirded out by that. I would not want to run a campaign like that and find out that the players hate that. But I think that testing it out in a one shot is a great opportunity to try a completely novel mechanic or something that's super dangerous. If you are interested, if you don't normally run like maybe classic D&D, something with a high body count, this is an opportunity where everybody's going to be okay if there's a TPK, actually. And so this is it's a reasonable time to maybe grab Tomb of Horrors, possibly. And I would run it better now than I have in the past, and say, yeah, probably everybody's going to die. Just accept that. And it's a lot more palatable than losing a campaign character through something that's very arbitrary. And there's a lot of Tomb of Horrors, it's very arbitrary. But maybe that's part of the puzzle, and that's part of the trickery, and that's a one-shot's a time that it's far more okay to try that out.
I mean, that kind of goes into kind of speaking to the same area as William's question about or comment about you know, magic items that are kind of nuke the world or you know, lots of charges or whatnot. Right, is to acknowledge also like the characters themselves are this as well to the players. Right, players of one shots are much more willing to take much bigger risks and risk death and possibly destroy their characters or just use up every resource available to them because and they're going to see this character again. So who cares? Right, so definitely prepare yourself for that. Right, your players will use those characters up completely.
Yeah. Yes. Indeed. Yeah.
I agree with you. I'm going to go back. Sorry. I agree with you that one shots are a great place to experiment, right? They're a great way. Like if you want to try new mechanics, some new content, something, it is absolutely, I agree, a great way to test something new. But I would also say try to limit the number of new things. Like it's maybe not the best setting to be like, I'm going to learn a whole new system, right? Like, yeah. This is your first time ever running a whole system. I get it. Yeah, actually, one shot, you maybe don't want to commit to a full campaign because you've never run this thing before. But like, if you're doing multiple things, if you're learning a lot at the table, that's going to slow you down. And as we said earlier, pacing is everything in one shots.
You're right. You're right. Totally. It's a good point. I think that's what some writers call a hat on a hat. Don't layer too many new topics one on top of another all at once.
Yeah.
I like, you know, so we're currently debating point scoring systems, and I actually like in my one shots, and you know that I normally do this, Paul, having some kind of scoring mechanism so I can announce to the team at the end like what their grade was.
Yeah.
And to be clear about like how well that went, actually, so I actually kind of like playing with those kind of point scoring systems myself.
I mean, it's a good example, I think, of the earlier point we were making about having goals, having a very strong, concrete goal.
Yeah.
The goal could simply be score better than anyone has ever scored before. And if you're upfront with your players, here's how you get points. Great. Yeah. You know, now they have a very concrete goal where they know exactly how to get ahead. I think that's, you know, or likewise, if you want to run something super dangerous, like Tomb of Horrors, especially Tomb of Horrors, which has this reputation, you can say, like, I'm going to run a one-shot of this game that's known to be incredibly deadly. You're all going to die. Your goal is make it to the end. See if you can survive. Right? That's a great goal. Why not?
Yeah. And it could be simple, like, you know, get the relic, right? It could be simple, yeah. Like just get the icon relic, but it can be like, you know, points for this and how much money you get back. And did you find the end point? And did you have this negotiation? That's all quite interesting, I think. And it focuses players. And certainly when I'm a player in that kind of situation, like I want to beat the game. And so the standard thing is Paul asking me, like, Dan, why are you playing this game? And my answer is to win the game, obviously. So I personally like having those goalposts to sink my teeth into. Kind of works for me as a player. You know, not everybody, but there's some people.
If you're another item just struck me. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, yep, pacing is everything. Okay, I got to be ready for cuts. I got to, you know, keep the game nice and tight in the time allowed. I would say another piece of advice is don't be afraid of allowing the game to end a little earlier than you expected. Like, yes. It is better for the game to end like half an hour early with a very satisfying bang of a climax than to try to fill that extra half hour at the end. Just don't bother. It's fine. No, in my experience, nobody complains about like, oh, the game ended a little bit earlier than expected, and now I have extra free time. If you're at a convention, they might appreciate the little extra time to get some food. If you're playing with friends, they might like appreciate the extra time to sit down and reminisce. What did you like? What didn't you like? In fact, it's a great way for you to get feedback. If you're learning how to run one shots, ask your players at the end, how'd it go? What'd you think? What was good? What was bad?
Yeah,
have a little time for that. It's great.
And if you're at a convention, you know, you're going to have time slots where there's other groups that are going to come to that table probably in just a couple minutes after your time slot. So it's really important to have that tight. I've, again, made that accident and gone long and be, you know, have awkward things as a result. Even if you're at home, right? People want to, you know, travel home and it's late at night and they either need to drive or here in New York, you know, get some kind of transit. And so, you know, so being, you know, honoring people's commitments or, you know, their time constraints is, you know, among the best things a DM can do, particularly if you're running a scenario more than once. You know, I now actually keep a time log of kind of the inverse of Satine Phoenix's advice. I actually keep a written time log of like what clock time we ended each beat on so that I can be aware of that in the future. Like I thought this was going to be a 20-minute scene and it turns out to be a 45 minute scene, then I might need to adjust this or something else about the scenario in the future. And so you know, not having objective facts about how much the time actually took rather than just my suspicion, because my adrenaline gets up and my experience of time just goes right out the window and becomes all wonky and not something I can trust. So I, you know, I actually log the time specifically so I can see what was happening and adjust later.
That's great. I wish I had the mental space to do that. I think is what I'm gonna say. Like I would love to take better notes while I'm running a game so that I can review later and say like, oh, this is what went well or what didn't go well. I think usually personally I'm just a little overloaded with all of the other tasks of DMing that taking notes about what's happening is probably falls to the side too much for me.
It's not easy, Paul, right? Yeah. It's hard. And part of the reason why I've say it out loud a number of times recently is to, you know, further commit myself to it. Because yeah, when you are DMing, there's a number of, you know, executive functioning tasks. There's the immediate thing that's happening, but you also have to keep your eye on the clock about how much time the whole scenario is blossoming out to. And yeah, that's to me, I think that is probably the time management is probably the hardest thing about managing those kinds of things and thinking about the two levels. And so hopefully if I have a piece of paper just for logging the time in front of me at some point, I'm going to glance down at it and go, right, here's where I am right now on this clock time. And I usually, you know, I have a watch with me. I put the watch on the table to keep it within sight all the time. And that is the most challenging thing. So you want to go in thinking about those time issues as paramount.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I'm reminded I did once run a game where I had an hourglass, a literal hourglass, right? It took exactly an hour for the sand to run out. And I put it on the table and I said, I'm going to turn this, whatever it is, three times. And when it runs out, we're done. Right? It is over. The game is over. And it was a nice visual reminder to keep that tension up of like, oh, we're running out of time. But the downside is, at least once I forgot to turn it. Right?
I was going to ask. That'd be so likely, right? I could go like an hour, right? I'd have that thing not running for like a whole hour before I think about it.
Before you notice it, yeah. It would be lovely to find like a 3-hour glass if such a thing existed. I've never found it. I'm sure they're out there somewhere. But.
You know, I have my watch in front of me normally, and I will announce. I guess as you know, what I do like for normal dungeon crawling stuff now is that the wandering monsters are on real clock time, and I'll announce. And I think my current rule is like every 15 minutes, I think, and I'll announce to the players, it's quarter past. Here comes the wandering guy. Bam, right? It's half past. Here comes the wandering guy. Is how I've been running it. And it's, you know, it's something, I don't know if it breaks out of the in-game context too much, but again, you got to be aware of that to some extent. So there it is.
Yeah. Let me run, I got some interesting advice from our viewers. I'm going to run this one by you, Dan. I want to get your reaction. So Joshua says, also go big. All that stuff you don't want to risk in a long-term campaign is on the table. Let them play 14th level characters. Give them some ridiculous artifacts to start. What do you think?
That's pretty much exactly what I do. I like running higher level stuff. You know, with players that know the system enough not to be overwhelmed by it, but that actually is very much what I do, is I run a lot of high level stuff for exactly that reason. So once again, take Josh's advice. It's excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you necessarily have to do it. High level is a way to go big, but I think just don't pull your punches, right? Like, don't be afraid to like really give it to the players, and you know, generally, I guess I would say this in any OD&D game is don't pull your punches. Like, let your players die horrifically, but go ahead and give them some impossible odds, right? You know, put them up against something that you think this will probably kill them all. Right? Why not? Why not have an end boss that they probably can't beat? But maybe they can if they're very clever. Why not? It's fun. If they make it, amazing. What an amazing game we just had. And if they didn't, no one's surprised.
Ultimately, it's a horror game. Your climactic, climactic scene is ultimately, hey, remember, D&D is a horror game, everybody. Surprise! You hadn't heard that before. Definitely. One other piece of advice. I don't know if you were going to say the same thing, Paul, that Backlius had in the chat, is we were talking about, you know, examples of dungeons or scenarios you could pick from, maybe classic stuff, maybe one-page dungeon stuff. Is Backlius, of course, was reminding us that you can also use Wandering DM's brand Dungeon Design Dash modules. And you can see when we did them, they're about the right size. They're around generally 7, 8, 10 encounterers is pretty much what you want. And they are on DriveThruRPG. So look for Wandering DMs on DriveThruRPG and you'll see a number of options that we've provided for you previously. Thank you for the reminder, Backways. I think those would be great options for a one-shot dungeon. Paul, are you possibly maybe trying out some of those, testing those for one-shot purposes in the near future, perhaps?
Indeed I am. You know, we had a great time making those dungeons on the show. I have run, I ran one of them actually as a horror scenario with Fearful Ends a while back. But in general, I would say I've not run them nearly enough. I decided recently of like, yeah, I'm going to just start running these. I want to see how they feel. I'm going to run one of them actually at our own local house con coming up in just a couple weeks. So hopefully, in the future, when we're doing a retrospective on that convention, I can let you all know how it went. Then we are about out of time. Any final thoughts on running a one-shot?
I think that the one-shots are, I'm so glad this was asked online, because I do think that one-shots are really great for a whole number of purposes. You get a really intense way to, try out the game, just like Josh said. You know, you can go big, you can try things that are high risk, high reward, and if you totally fall on your face, that's okay. You're just going to, move on to the next game. If it's a TPK, everybody understands that this was just going to be one time anyway. If you're, new to playing or DMing, it's a great opportunity to, test your chops, see if you like that particular type of play. Maybe try out a new system as a possible option, and challenge yourself with new mechanics or ideas. But yes, number one, you need to keep your eye on the clock. You need to keep the players invested and have interesting pacing and keep within your, constrained time purposes. Edit on the fly if you need to, because yes, number one is time management. That is, always keep that in mind for your meta awareness.
Yeah. It's I think like one of the biggest differences between running a one shot and a campaign style is that the campaign game goes on ostensibly forever, right? And so you can always just say like, well, we're out of time, guys. We'll pick it up here next time. And you do not get that in a one shot. It is now or never. So, yeah.
Very true. Very true.
Sorry. Or as Joshua reminds us, proper timekeeping is essential.
Proper timekeeping is essential. Yes. It's as true as today is when it was first written. Thank you, Josh, for that.
Viewers, if you have any thoughts on running a one-shot, other tips or tricks you want to share with us, other adventures that you think make really good one-shots, please post here in the comment section of our YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe you will give us some ideas for a future show.
And definitely, and remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, TikTok, places like that, and we have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please fracture that like button.
Like my ankle.
Sorry. A trick warning. Sorry.
Interesting use of choice of words, Dan.
That wasn't intentional. I'm sorry.
Viewers, if you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those podcasts at our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcast on various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Podcast, Podcast Addict, all kinds of places like that. If you are listening to the show right now on one of those sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every one of our tiers gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, we'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation with a live video after chat that we enjoy with our viewers every week. So we would love to see you there if you're a returning patron there or you're new. We love that video after chat. And also, don't forget, coming up on this week on the Wandering DMs channel, I'll have another episode of Dan's Old Time Mini Show on Thursday night. And we started making a mold for the Space Monkeys of the Star Frontiers game, the Azirians, and hopefully I'll complete that mold. I started painting some of the miniatures, like the blobby Drallocytes, and I'm getting some great advice, which I need, from people like Paul and Baclius about how I can go forward, because that's the part that I'm most shaky on. So please tune in and help me out as I start with the painting stuff of that. And that's Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time now. We'd love to see you there. So we will be back next week as usual. Don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.